TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Race, Gender, and Class Struggle. This is the second part of a one-hour-long talk given in April 2006 by Michael Parenti. Parenti is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts and a highly respected author. In part one, Michael Parenti had explained how race, gender, and class are interrelated and part of a systemic dynamic. Racism and sexism are used and abused and often prevent unity among those who find themselves at the bottom of the social power structure. Parenti explains that racism and sexism can't be overcome unless we understand what role they play in a class-based society. Here is Michael Parenti.
Much of politics, ladies and gentlemen, much of politics is the rational manipulation of irrational symbols. So racist emotions and fear and resentment may be irrational emotions. They may have irrational imagery and the like, but they are often rationally manipulated and pursued. Historically, racism comes from two great class exploitative forces. One is slavery. No slavocracy rules nakedly. No ruling class of any kind rules nakedly. They all, whether it's the Chinese landlord class or the feudal class in Europe or ancient slavocracies or the American antebellum slavocracy or the ruling plutocratic class today, they all build up an ideology to justify their rule. The Chinese landlords used to say, "The sun cannot rise in the west." This is what they told the peasants. That meant you can no more change position with me or equalize our positions than the sun can rise in the west. Don't ask for the impossible. So they represented their very privileged and very exploitative and unjust system as the natural order of society, you see. In the U.S., slavocracy developed religion. The clergy were actively involved. Not just in the South, in the North too, many clergy involved in justifying slavery. The slaves, you know, were the descendants of Ham. Ham was dark, if you remember, read the Bible. He was dark, and all his children, therefore, shall be the hewers of wood and drawers of water. The colleges in the North were prohibited from discussing and pursuing and advocating abolitionism. The intellectuals and professors in Southern colleges full-time pursuing justifications for slavery and why it was building up a whole science and anthropology and sociology and psychology as to why slavery was a just natural thing, because the slave was lazy, shiftless, this and that. There were psychiatrists in America who studied a very real mental illness that existed at this time. It doesn't exist anymore, and it afflicted only slaves. It was called drapetomania, and it was the irresistible impulse that possessed some slaves to abscond from service, was the term, to run away. And this was an illness that slaves suffered from. Eminent doctor, the Samuel Cartwright himself, I have a quote in my book, The Culture Struggle, and he talks about this. He says, "Drapetomania is a mental illness like any other, and there are cures for it. The cures consisted of ferocious applications of the bullwhip and branding on the face and chains and, in some extreme cases, castration. Those were the cures. These were the best minds of science in the early 19th century giving us what to do about this." Another source of racism is imperialism. The imperialists are not out to conquer other people simply because they're not white or they're of a different ethnic group. They don't care. The imperialists don't care what color you are. They're very democratic in who they kill. I mean, I used to hear when they were bombing Vietnam, they said they would never bomb Europe. Well, and what happened in Yugoslavia? They were bombing Europe. We saw countries bombing right in the heart of Europe. This is 40 years after World War II, when we thought all that was over, that was passed on a stage of history. They bomb, they'll kill anybody, they'll kill their own mothers if they can get more. They're not interested in the color line, they're interested in the bottom line. The first victims of Western European imperialism were Eastern Europeans, who were Caucasians. The oldest colony that the English ever built, and one they still have a piece of, was Ireland. And you can't get any more pink-faced and fair-faced than the Irish are. But when they went into Latin America and Africa and Asia, it was for what was in that land. They went in for the tin, the copper, the manganese, the bauxite, the oil. Let me repeat that one. The oil, the iron, silver, the gold, the cotton, the hemp, the tobacco, the rum. You can name it, go on and on. The foods, just the foods, and the labor. The Roman Empire, the Romans were big on that one, that one of the reasons you conquered a country was for the labor, because that labor, that human labor creates wealth for you. Slaves. Or if not slaves, certainly exploited labor. But after you're in there a while, you've got to justify it. See, if I come in and I slaughter your herds and burn your crops and destroy your mines and burn down your well-built buildings, I can give you descriptions of that. French military in North Africa admiring these buildings of various tribes they had to burn down and like and kill. And I enslave your men in the mines and rape your women and spit your babies on bayonets or whatever all the various atrocities are. I have to, after a while, justify it. And what I say is, well, they're animals. I do what every ruling class, every murderous class has ever done in history. I reverse the role of victim and victimizer. I talk about, look at the literature in America about the Native American Indians. Fierce red devils, ferocious, cutthroating, scalping. Scalping was a European Caucasian innovation. The Indians learned it from the white man. But you go on, talk about how the only good engine is a dead engine. They're horrible creatures. They're animals. So you start developing this, again, mythology of these wretched subhuman people who you by necessity need to do in. You see that with gender also. Women have been subjected to the oppressions of men for mere, 5 million years, whatever it is. And of course, there builds up the view of women as a liability. They're fickle, they're silly, they're lightheaded, they're superficial, they're... what?
Needy, clingy,
treacherous. And if you get into Christianity, they're worse. They're seductresses, and they are the purveyors of evil. Who gave Adam that apple, huh? By the way, it wasn't an apple. Read the Bible, there's no apple. It was a fruit. Although apple was a generic term. But I'm digressing, let's get back to it. The Jezebel, the woman is Jezebel. That's another big theme and all that sort of thing. I deal with that in the culture struggle. Custom against women, I have two chapters in there. That sort of thing goes on. Now, conservatives in modern day America, I think, have consciously cultivated these race and gender issues and other what they call culture issues as a way of distracting people from looking at bread and butter issues, that is, class struggle issues. I actually saw a Sunday afternoon show. It was William Buckley and some of his other, you know, the whole bunch of these right-wing pundits who overpopulate the TV channels. And they were talking about this. How do we get Joe Sixpack and Middle America to come on over to our side, and we should consciously pursue these culture issues? You know, it was interesting. They didn't say it all. They didn't say, look, we're ripping them off, and we're getting our tax cuts for the super rich, and they're paying most of it, and they're a bunch of suckers, but we got to justify it and distract them. They didn't use the word distract, but say, bring to their attention these kind of things. Family values. Well, we should talk more family values. Family values are important to the working Joe. For instance, abortion. There's an important gender right. Conservatives used to be for abortion. Ronald Reagan signed one of the most liberal abortion bills up to that point in American history when he was governor of this state. George Bush Sr., George I, when he was in Congress, voted for abortion bills. They were for abortion. They thought the poor had too many babies. They would go on welfare, all this deadwood on our economy and this and that. And abortion is a good solution. It was only that when they realized that abortion could be an issue that could split the traditionally Catholic Democratic vote and also mobilize and ignite some rural, low-income Protestant fundamentalist vote. It had an emotive effect to it and all that, that they began to argue that a fertilized ovum was a human being who had priorities over the mature human being that was carrying this fertilized ovum. The other issues, of course, gay rights, gay marriage. I mean, that was like throwing red meat at them just before the 2004 election. Isn't that right? That suddenly gay marriage became the issue there. And the most persistent one was family values. Again and again, the family value hypocrites, you know. You had Phil Graham, who dumped his wife and ran off with his secretary, talking about family values. You had Newt Gingrich, who, when his wife was lying in bed with cancer, almost dying, coming in with the divorce papers and having her sign the divorce papers in the hospital. Late 80s, you remember this, where these... a number of congressmen, family value guys, it was discovered, had been cavorting with male prostitutes, had been bringing male prostitutes up to Capitol Hill and buying their services. Male prostitutes. I mean, when I read that, I just was so shocked and disgusted and just fed up with it. It really lowered my opinion of male prostitutes. Well... who are hard-working guys, hey? Well, aside from ethnic divisions, we should note there have been cases, even in recent years, where there has been ethnic and gender unity in labor struggles. And that means this came in the crucible of class struggle. The labor struggles... in recent years, for instance, you've had African Americans, Latinos, Asians, Filipinos, white workers, male and female, standing shoulder to shoulder in major strikes by steel workers, coal miners, dock workers, teachers, hospital employees. Those are the ones that I was able to get down, and I'm sure there are others too. Let me tell you something else about the class divide and how it's seldom noticed because we concentrate exclusively on race and gender. Blue-collar workers, regardless of race, are 2.3 times more likely to die of heart disease than managers and professionals. In contrast, black males are only 1.2 times more likely, only. But I mean, that's a terrible, but it's less. In other words, class is a greater divide. Lower-income people of whatever race and gender are more likely to report poor health than upper-income people of whatever race and gender. In other words, the morbidity rates have to be explained by looking at class as well as race and gender. But the U.S. government collects data only on race and gender while ignoring class. And now I want to point out that this negligence is not indicative of a lack of class awareness, but of a keen sense of class, a sense of keeping it off the agenda and out of our consciousness. And that is why they will not discuss class. And those who do discuss class, even among many who pretend to be on the left, get very nervous and very labeling and very uncomfortable. It's happened to me in much of my career, and I'm not talking about the William Buckleys. I'm talking about allegedly progressive people. I remember all along, all the way up when I was doing this stuff, people quick to label me a Marxist. Are you a Marxist? And I said, if I was sure you understood what you meant by that word, the same as I understood what I mean by it, then I would say yes. But since I'm not sure, I'd have to say, I don't know, and neither do you, really. You don't know what that means. And I would... I would write something on... I'd talk about the police. I say, you know, the police are not neutral. They do not... They don't just keep law and order. They have that function, too. But they have a class function. They support the big property on the factory against the workers. Why are they protecting the factory? Why aren't they helping the workers go into the factory? It's if there's a lockout, let's say, in violation of a contract and all that. And people would say, oh, well, that's Marx. Isn't that Marx? That's Marx. Or I'd say, you know, I don't think the U.S. is really promoting democracy abroad and giving aid and all. I think they're going in and they're doing this and exploiting and I'm talking about imperialism. And I say, oh, that's Marx. That's Marx. And I'd say, you know, I think race is not just a matter of attitude. It's, you know, some of the things I say here and this and this. And they'd say, that sounds a little, that's Marx. That's Marx. And after a while, I started thinking, oh, this guy Marx is pretty good, you know. Here I am busting my back trying to come up with an analysis. And every time I do, they give him the credit, you know. And he's been dead 120 years or something. The courts, too. The courts ignore class and consider only race and gender as categories for equal treatment under the law. And why? Because of what I said before. You can't have equality in class. Were they to have equality of class under the law, this would have revolutionary implications. Whereas with race and gender, they can finesse. They can bring in people. They can elect black mayors, or they can appoint black secretaries of states. They can bring in women into office. But what blacks? What women? What women? Lynn Cheney, Jean Kirkpatrick. And just after we're just recovering from Jean Kirkpatrick, we get Madeleine Albright. Just recovering from her, and we get Condoleezza Rice, Mamma Mia. I mean, this is, and who satisfies two categories of identity politics? She's black, and she's a female. And you find that they can still perform the same class supremacy functions as any white male can. By the way, I'm not saying that having women on the Supreme Court, having women in high positions of government, is a totally immaterial thing. That's a good advance, but it's a very misleading concession. It's used opportunistically. It's harnessed by those whose real concern, after all, is again not the color line but the bottom line. Let me close here by telling you about the study that Robert Cole was doing. Robert Cole, Harvard psychologist, he's interviewing black people in communities and white people. And he found that many ordinary African Americans had a sense of not only class, but of class power. He found that many working class women doing two shifts at Walmarts and living out of a van have a sense of class exploitation and class struggle. Cole's African American respondents would ask him if he also had interviewed the rich folks. And Cole said, you mean the white folks, not the rich folks, right? And they said, no, we mean, quote, the rich, the ones who decide how the poor folks live. To Cole's credit, this is his own account, to his credit, I'll say that. He's showing his readers what a dense head he is on the class issue, as every Harvard professor pretty much is, almost. not to mention Yale and Princeton. One African-American lawyer told Cole that if he wanted to know why black people live the way they do, he should talk not to the ordinary working-class white people who were also victimized, but to the affluent and powerful ones who own the farmlands and the factories. I quote this lawyer. They own everything, and they decide what happens in this city and in all the other cities. Unquote. Now, it gets even more interesting. Cole found surprisingly similar opinions among working-class whites. They, too, railed against the rich, or the big shots with plenty of money and all the power they want. So what you had here was these interviewees, working-class African-Americans, working-class whites, were introducing the famous Harvard professor to the concept not of class, but of class power. They were taking him to school about something that academics and intellectuals have systematically programmed out of their perception. He interviewed working-class people, and he didn't ask them about class or class power. Isn't that kind of extraordinary? That's an extraordinary achievement when you think about it, but it's not so extraordinary that you don't get tenure at some of these places if you're going to be doing that Marx stuff, you see. So in sum, we don't have a full understanding of the functional imperatives of racism and sexism unless we take into account the political economic context, the class power structure. Unless we move from attitudinal racism and sexism to institutional and systemic analyses. I'm not arguing that you can reduce all of racism and sexism to the analysis I gave you today. I do believe there are imperatives, historical and whatever else, which develop their own momentum and have their own connections. You see that especially in the case of gender. But even there, you know, a society where you have education available for women, entry into decent job markets for women, human services to support them and their children or to back them up and give them some kind of backup. In those societies, women have a better chance against male oppression than they do in Pakistan or Afghanistan or other places like that, where women have no system. So systemic factors can come in even in that historic oppression of men over women like that. I welcome identity politics and the vital war that's waged against racism, sexism, and homophobia. But you know, it's been 35 years where identity politics has been used as an excuse, as a means to deny confronting the political economic realities of reactionary class power that is slamming us in the head all the time, that preys upon us ever more viciously and openly. The failure to perceive racial and gender oppression within the context of class power oppression leads to what I call the competition of oppressions. I remember also one time in Washington, D.C., at a meeting, a guy getting up, a black man, and she says, "Yeah, you may be a woman, but you're white, and you don't know what I have to deal with." And she says, "Yeah, well, you may be black, but you're a man, and you don't know what I have to deal with." And another woman gets up and says, "Yeah, well, neither of you know what it means to be a lesbian. If I went in and to an employer and announced I was a lesbian, you guys would get the job far ahead of me." So there they all, I got up and said, what is this? What are we doing here? It's the competition for oppressions, which is, I'm more oppressed than you, which means, first of all, I feel my oppression more than you are going to feel it, and you have no empathy for it. But also, it means that mine is more urgent, and we should be giving our limited resources to this struggle. That's what happens when you treat this Holy Trinity as mutually exclusive and in competition with each other, rather than seeing that the people who are giving you homophobia and the outlawing of gay marriage and the people who are outlawing abortions and the people who are giving us racism and the people are the same people who are bombing Iraq and giving these tax cuts that top fraction of 1%, and the same people who are doing all these other things and rolling back all the social democratic gains of the 20th century that took generations of struggle. Those are the same people. And once we see that, then we're on a better track, I think. Let me close with a little story, which is a true story, When the committees of correspondence, were forming in 1992, they had their founding convention in Berkeley, California, where I had just moved to Berkeley that year, and it was just a 20-minute walk away up on the Cal campus, so I went up there and I attended the, and I saw a lot of people I knew and all that, and there was a conference, and they were setting up, this is the founding conference. I never did join, but I was observing anyway, and they were setting up the statements of intentions and their standards, you know, and their goals and all that. And some guy got the microphone on the floor and he said, there's nothing in our charter here about gay rights. You put something in, please, gay rights. And people up on the stage there, gay and lesbian rights. And they said, oh, right, gay and lesbian rights. Then another guy got up and transgender and transsexual had not yet quite come into vogue. That was a few years down the line. But he said, no, it should be gay, lesbian, and bisexual rights because we bisexuals run into discrimination from both communities, he said. Versatile little rascal that he was. So there he was. So they said, yes, that's right, gay, lesbian, and bisexual rights. And I was sitting back there, and there was this old lefty trade unionist sitting behind me, and I hear him say, he said it's just loud enough for people around him, he says, yeah, and how about putting something in there for the people who are too tired to have sex when they get home from work? And brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, that's who I speak for, the people who are too tired to have sex when we get home from work, which, by the way, also includes any number of gays, lesbians, bisexual, African-American, Latinos, everybody else. Okay, thank you very much.
This was the second half of a one-hour program on race, gender, and class struggle by Michael Parenti. With roots in a working-class Italian neighborhood in New York and a PhD in political science from Yale, Michael Parenti has become an internationally known lecturer. He is the author of 19 books, among them The Assassination of Julius Caesar, History as Mystery, and Democracy for the Few. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order a CD or audio tape or a film on DVD of this talk. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your order of a copy of this program is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD or DVD by mail or credit card by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.